wanted the best, you've got the best podcast. The hottest podcast in the world. The Chris Voss Show, the preeminent podcast with guests so smart you may experience serious brain bleed. The CEOs, authors, thought leaders, visionaries, and motivators. Get ready. Strap yourself in. Keep your hands, arms, and legs inside the vehicle at all times, because you're about to go on a monster education roller coaster with your brain. Now, here's your host, Chris Voss.
Hi, folks. It's Voss here from thechrisvossshow.com. There you go. Welcome to the big show, ladies and gentlemen. When the Iron Lady sings it, that makes it official. We have, as always, the most amazing, smartest minds, the authors that bring you the greatest, latest stories, tales of their journeys, lessons of life, all that sort of good stuff on the Chris Voss Show. Today we have an amazing gentleman on the show. His newest book comes out April 9th, 2024. It's called Tripped: Nazi Germany, the CIA, and the Dawn of the Psychedelic Age. We're going to find out a lot of history that I didn't even know about. I was like, what? What is all this stuff about? I did not know. Norman Oler joins us on the show with us today. He'll be talking to us about all of his insights. Well, hello, Norman. How are you?
I'm quite good. Very happy to be on the show.
Very happy to have you. I am good as well. Give us any .coms. Where do you want people to find you on the interwebs?
Well, my website is normanoler.com. Also, you can find me on Instagram at normanoler. Mm-hmm. Go for it.
There you go. So you're an award-winning German novelist, screenwriter, and journalist. You spent 5 years researching Blitz in numerous archives, your previous book, in Germany and the U.S. So tell us what, give us a 30,000 overview of your new book, Tripped.
Well, I was researching... Blitz, all aspects of Nazi drug abuse. I came across also psychedelic research that the Nazis did with mescaline and another substance at the concentration camp of Dachau. And I thought this is actually an interesting topic, because I thought the early history of psychedelics must be interesting because they shaped the way how we see psychedelics today. So I decided for a new book to kind of look at that particular situation.
There you go. And you prompted it because you wrote Blitz. And Blitz was, do you give us an update on what Blitz was so people are familiar with that book as well?
Well, Blitz examines, and it was the first time this was examined, how National Socialism, who proclaimed to be the first anti-drug government in Europe and actually in the world, was actually using a lot of substances to promote their own goals. The German army, the Wehrmacht, was high on methamphetamine when they invaded first Poland and then the West. Wow. And Hitler himself took a crazy drug cocktail, which I examined, and from which you can, you know, see his developments and his decision making. So that was, yeah, in research terms, quite interesting for me, actually.
There you go. And you talk about how the Third Reich was saturated with cocaine, opioids, meth, but they were just having a party over there while they were running over.
You. Well, I mean, they were kind of the forerunners in trying to use drugs for their own, you know, goals. So this was like a government-regulated drug policy. So they weren't doing it to have fun. They were actually doing it to, you know, promote, you know, National Socialism and win the war. So they were utilizing drugs to their ends, basically. At least they tried to.
I know the British pilots, I think, were on Adderall or something, weren't they? They were on something to keep them awake so they could keep flying.
Well, they kind of learned from the Germans, because the Germans were the first army to actually use a very potent synthetic drug, which was methamphetamine, crystal meth, as we know it today, in order to keep soldiers awake longer, to reduce their fear levels, to make them more aggressive. And the Brits at one point understood that the Germans were kind of using a trick, or were using a new type of, you know, weapon, which is the pharmaceutical weapon. So they also made tests, and then they decided that they would use amphetamines, not methamphetamines, because that was too strong, the British thought. That's like, only the Nazis should take methamphetamine, we take amphetamines. But that also influenced the British war machine quite a bit, and even armies today use amphetamines. So this is kind of a Nazi invention that had a career even after the end of World War II.
Wow. And so you go into the depth of this Tripped and what you call the dawn of the psychedelic age. Why do you call this the dawn of the psychedelic age?
I mean, LSD, which is the most potent psychedelic substance, was founded in 1943. Mm-hmm. And the company that founded it is Swiss pharmaceutical company, Sandoz in Basel, Switzerland, like very normal pharmaceutical firm, thought they had a big hit on their hands because LSD was the first medication that actually worked on the mind. And they realized in 43, we have a world war going on. We'll have lots of traumatized people, lots of people with psychological problems after this conflict. Mm-hmm. So maybe LSD is like a huge, is going to be a huge hit. They actually thought this was a game changer for the pharmaceutical industry in general, more like psychedelics. They kind of invented and developed psychedelic medicines. But then something happened and LSD kind of was not able to develop normally like a medicine. Like they couldn't put it on the market. And I was curious in finding out why.
Interesting. Interesting. Now, of course, we beat Germany in the wars, and so you have the U.S. is interested in, and I guess the Russians and the Britain and France who are overseeing Germany at that time. You have the U.S. get interested in the CIA, I guess, in what the Germans were doing with these drugs.
I mean, the Americans were extremely interested in all, you know, things that German scientists were working on, because German scientists had this aura of being geniuses and they're really far advanced. Also, in terms of the nuclear weapon, the Americans developing their own weapon thought the Germans might you know, be have some steps ahead of us. So they were when America liberated Germany, they had a secret unit attached to many military units. It was called the Alsos unit, and Alsos' job, it was a mixture of soldiers and agents, was to interview, like to first find and then interview German scientists regarding nuclear weapon technology, but also the biochemical weapons. And under this area, also they were interested in drugs as possible weapons. And then they found that the Nazis had already experimented with LSD, which actually no one had ever written about, that LSD has this Nazi past, because we think LSD is this hippie drug.
I thought
it's very 60s. Interesting to look at that, you know, what actually happened. The Nazis thought it could be used as a weapon. So the Americans also thought it could be used as a weapon. Mm-hmm. That's why Sandoz, the Swiss company, was not able to just bring it on the market, because they got huge pressure from the newly founded CIA, who was very interested in winning this new war that was now starting, which was the Cold War, which was brain warfare, as the CIA head, Dulles, also called it, because it was about ideologies. It was this struggle against the Soviet Union, who has the better model. So the thought that a drug could actually help you overpower the mind of someone else, for example, in an interrogation, which was attractive to the Nazis, was now very attractive to the CIA.
Yeah. Kind of interesting. What if it had become an open drug for sale on the market? It might have been kind of... You wonder sometimes, I mean, how these things would have happened, if things would have been different.
I mean, today we know that LSD can be good against dementia, against depression, against trauma, mm-hmm. just like psilocybin and some other psychedelic substances. But at the time, they were suspecting this, and at Sandoz, in this pharmaceutical company, they opened up a so-called, they called it intoxication room. It was like a room within the company, and people, this was in the mid-40s, could go there, like the chemists could go there, or secretaries or bookkeepers of the company, and they got LSD, and they didn't know what it was. They just took it, and then they described, and everyone described like wonderful experiences. Like looking out the window, the sky became very beautiful. Suddenly they understood their own life, or they just became happy. They couldn't stop smiling. So Sandoz really thought this LSD is like a brain food. It's like something that really makes people feel better and think better. So this is actually the dawn of the psychedelic age, which was then had to go underground, because LSD became illegal in the United States and then worldwide. And now the research is actually starting up again. So in a way, now we have a second dawn of the psychedelic age. Now we have a real dawn, because now scientists are actually more and more able to research LSD, psilocybin, ketamine, MDMA in the lab to see, can it really help against dementia? How long will it take until we have the first psychedelic medicine against Alzheimer's? like these questions are now really being examined in the universities worldwide. So actually now we have the dawn of the psychedelic age.
Is it was it made illegal so that other governments couldn't get a hold of it or interest in it to try and squash any sort of, other governments doing what the CIA wanted to do it, do you think? Was there like a dirty tricks there going on?
I mean, the documents are pretty clear about it, that there was the big fear, or at least the fear was proclaimed or was, you know, worded that the other side, the Soviet Union, uses truth drugs that they will apply against us, and in order so they don't get an advantage, we also have to do it. There was never any proof actually for a long time that the Soviet Union was into this, but later on it became clear that the Czechoslovakia, which was a Soviet satellite, actually had a huge LSD program. So the Eastern Bloc, they actually were working on it, but they were not really working on it to develop it as a weapon, but they were just kind of researching it in the East. So the CIA created a program called MKUltra, which was headed by one guy. He became very worried that Sandoz, the Swiss company, Switzerland being a neutral country, would just sell it to everyone. So he visited the CEO of Sandoz and requested that larger amounts of LSD that are being sold by the company have to be run through the FDA, the CIA. So the American, basically the CIA, always knew about the supply situation of LSD in the world. So they could, they wanted to control it because they thought it's such a potent molecule. Basically, that's what it is. It's just a molecule, and it is very potent.
Yeah. Here I thought the war of drugs, they thought they were doing something good. Like, maybe everyone should be high all the time. Turns out it was the CIA being an asshole. They did the same thing with crack, so that was interesting. So this, you document how the CIA basically starts turning, trying to turn LSD into a truth serum. And they even did some pretty evil stuff during the psychological brainwashing torture program during the 50s and 60s.
Well, I mean, when the guy who headed MKUltra, his name was Sidney Gottlieb, when he first received LSD on his visit to Switzerland from the CEO of Sandoz, the company that made it, he first tried it on himself. He realized that on himself it has a very powerful effect, like he can think differently. And then he wondered, what happens if I give this to someone without telling that person that I do this? So that's the human experiment that then starts, and in this he included American universities. So American universities were testing how would LSD affect the mind, how does it increase your fear level if you take it unwittingly, what happens if you take it in a nice surrounding, can you destabilize someone? So they looked at all kinds of questions. So this MKUltra program was in a way a research, a big research program, secret research program by the CIA in order to find out, could we somehow perhaps smuggle LSD into the water supply of a Soviet battleship? What would happen then? Would they all go crazy? Would they, you know, they really tried to get a grip on how to weaponize LSD. And that is the MKUltra program. And obviously it's an unethical program because it used American citizens, foreign citizens, without their knowledge. Like the CIA created two safe houses, one in Greenwich Village, New York, one in San Francisco. They kind of picked up people from the street or out of, from bars, invited them to private parties in the apartments, gave them LSD without knowing, and then they saw how the people changed. So These are actually kind of weird. Yeah, they're kind of dark experiments. And they're all based on what the Nazis did in the concentration camp of Dachau. Because the Nazis started and the Americans kind of saw it and kind of copied it, softened it maybe a little bit, but not much actually. So we can see that drug abuse from the Nazis actually is mirrored in the U.S. and then lead to the prohibition of the substance, because at one point the CIA realizes this is not a weapon and actually people like it and some get quote-unquote turned on by it or develop new thought forms or become creative, and this is not what the CIA had in mind. So it's not surprising that in 66 suddenly LSD then becomes illegal. It's being called a class one substance. Class one is like the most dangerous one that have no medicinal use, and you cannot even from now on examine it in universities anymore, because it's also illegal to research it.
Wow. That's crazy, but it does sound like the CIA and how they did things. So you're able to track all this stuff. Sadly, for people who are put into jail for this, probably for long periods of time. What do you hope people come away with on the book, and what do you hope that they learn from the story?
Well, right now we hear quite a lot about the so-called psychedelic renaissance, and more states in the U.S. are legalizing this substance or that substance. And the war on drugs is not really going very well for the American government. Everyone knows that. Mm-hmm. The war on drugs is basically not winnable. So slowly new concepts of are being discussed, like what are these drugs actually? Is LSD maybe not a dangerous substance, but maybe it's a brain food that everyone should take in microdosages? That's what the new science actually points at. But we don't know this yet because we need much more research. So much more research will actually happen because we as a species, especially in the West, we always like to go like a little further. Like this is the new frontier. It's the frontier of the mind. Why would a government not allow us to develop freely? Why is there like a chemical wall set up in our brain, which is not founded on scientific, conclusions? That the anti-drug laws are not based on lots of studies done by, you know, independent scientists that prove that drugs are dangerous. These drug laws are based on ideological footing. And this is what I examine in the book. So just people get a little bit more of a sense of the history of these drugs. What are psychedelics? Where do they come from? Why did they become illegal? What is the danger of them? So I think it just helps you to, you know, understand for yourself about the topic. And I think it is an important topic, and also to, you know, be able to talk about it, because, you know, people will talk about it more and more. So Trip actually gives you a good advantage in that discussion, I think.
There you go. And then on your book, Blitz, I mean, it's kind of an extension of that, really, when it comes down to it, I think, isn't it? This book, Trip?
Yeah, I mean, they both are concerned with drugs in history. Trip obviously is more also about the American history, because the psychedelic era is really, you know, it's just like the internet boom that was a few decades ago. Now it's a psychedelic boom. And again, America, it's happening in America. And it's more of an American book, while Blitz was more of a German book, but they kind of, they give each other their hand. So you could read the one without the other, but if you read both of them, obviously you get a very good overview and picture.
There you go. So it was pretty interesting, man. I guess they were really high over there in Germany. Was the whole country high? You write in the book, Blitz, about how everyone from mothers to everybody, to all the way up to Hitler, were having a pretty interesting time.
I mean, I can only look at the production numbers and the sales numbers and then at the population numbers. And I mean, methamphetamine was in Germany in the late 30s just as popular as coffee is in our society, because there was no coffee, actually. I mean, maybe you could get a coffee somewhere, but it wasn't like today. And people always need stimulants. Like we're living in a capitalist, performance-oriented society. We all want to be the best. Like that's how we survive. So if there's something on the market from which we think this makes us, you know, perform better, then we use it. And in Germany, it was methamphetamine. I mean, sounds crazy, but it was not crystal meth that was cooked in some black market lab. You know, it was done by a German pharmaceutical company. The name was Temmler. They invented methamphetamine. These tablets were pure. They were not so high dose. So you could, you know, take a methamphetamine, and it was like drinking maybe 3 cups of coffee, but it lasts for like 6 hours. So it's not that everyone was crazy, but everyone was kind of going on a certain level. You know, not everyone, you know, also not everyone took it, but it was a mass drug, a mass product. There was even chocolate on the market laced with methamphetamine for the housewives, because the Nazis wanted the women to stay at home and clean the house. That was like the role model, so that they were eating meth chocolate, so it would be at least more fun to clean the house.
Yeah, I've known people that when they want to clean their house, they do meth, and they'll for 3 days they'll be awake cleaning their house. I'm just like Chris, if you ever want to clean your house, do some meth. And I'm like, no, thanks. I really like my teeth. But there's that.
Well, for example, the meth in Germany, you didn't the teeth didn't fall out. I mean, those are those are like black meth, crystal meth, you know, from the black market, you know.
Yeah.
And still, obviously, it's not a healthy product because you develop at least a psychological dependency. You want to have it. That's why people like wrote about depression, like suddenly you don't. They didn't understand it in Germany because it was not considered a drug. It was like legally, you could buy it at any pharmacy. Just walk in, say, I want some meth, and you got it.
Wow. It's like living. I don't have a joke for that. So this is really interesting. It's with all the drugs that were going on, do you think it's what contributed to the moral failure of Germans to, you know, the horrors that they did to the Jewish people, the Holocaust, the experiments they were doing on live people? Do you think the drugs contributed to the moral failures of what most of us that try and consider ourselves humans, you know, the drugs were contributing to some very poor decision making, basically? Do you think that was maybe part of what was creating some of that, or?
Well, I think the creation of these programs, like the racist ideology of the Nazis and the the plan of the Holocaust and all this, I think this was methamphetamine, and also they developed these ideas before methamphetamine was actually invented.
Oh, really?
But it's a fact that people, I mean, Hitler wrote Mein Kampf in the late 20s, and methamphetamine was invented in 38. Oh,
okay.
So it's not like that the Nazis became bad because they took a lot of methamphetamine, but it is a fact that people working within the machine, for example, being concentration camp guards, I mean, these were also, you know, normal people like you and me. Their job was to guard a concentration camp. Obviously, this is not easy, you know, because you see things, you do things that are absolutely horrendous, mm-hmm. and the methamphetamine does help you to actually do these things. And we have seen that people who do for shootings, for example, or even the attack against Israel on October 7th, they found Captagon, which is an Arabic type of methamphetamine with the fighter. So this methamphetamine does, this was actually proven at German universities in the late 30s. It lowers your inhibitions, like you're ready to commit things that you otherwise wouldn't do because you resist. You know, people usually don't kill other people. Like, it's very hard. We don't want to do this, but on crystal meth, on methamphetamine, it's easier because you're like in a bad movie, so to say, and you have this energy, and in your brain, all those neurotransmitters are released that send you into high alert. So you're like at high alert. You're fighting
fight or flight
for your life. You're not normal, calm. You know, you're not sitting cross-legged meditating on crystal meth, on methamphetamine. So I believe that it was easier for people to take part, also as a soldier. I mean, amphetamines and methamphetamines are perfect for soldiers. You take it, you have more energy, you have less fear, you just want to go. It certainly contributed to the horrors of the Third Reich. If they all would have smoked weed, I think a lot less atrocities would have happened. Because you just don't want to do these things.
Yeah, just like we're not.
But on methamphetamine, you might want to do these things because you're so like hyper and you just want to act. I mean, I wouldn't, but you know, soldiers who are already in combat situation on crystal meth are more crazy in those combat situations, and they shoot more and they do more and they kill more, I think. You know, that's what my research showed for sure.
Yeah, maybe we should have pot, because you're right. Pot, you're just like, oh, let's not fight. Let's just all get along. And it does explain. I had heard that one of the aspects was Germans who lived outside of the camps would have from time to time ash from the winds of the Holocaust furnaces, the ash would fall into their neighborhoods, and they, sometimes they would say, you know, today's a a day where there's going to be a lot of ash, and so keep everyone inside. And maybe, you know, mothers and people at home getting high on their supply contributed to them turning a blind eye to that sort of lack of humanity going on. I mean, they knew what was going on inside of the concentration camps, evidently.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, when you've got ash falling in your neighborhood and you know that it's from human beings, yeah, it probably takes a lot to turn a blind eye to that, because that's really something. But, you know, like you say, I guess once you go down that rabbit hole of hate and anti-Semitism and, you know, the racial purity sort of BS they put in Mein Kampf and stuff and promoted, you know, just adding drugs to that, drug fueling that, probably just is not going to lead to better things. I imagine we might have been kind of, it's a weird way of saying it, we might have been blessed that Hitler was as high as he was more of the time, because he really made some bad decisions in the end. You know, one of the decisions to open two fronts to attack Russia at the same time he was fighting through Europe. You know, that was a downfall of the military in Germany. And, you know, some of the decisions he made, I think, there at the end really helped us win the war.
I mean,
and you think if he had have been high, maybe he might have been more dangerous when it came to strategy in the end.
I would assume so. I mean, I discussed my findings about Hitler with Hans Mommsen, who was at the time when I researched the book, the leading historian, like the gentleman of history in Germany on National Socialism. Like, he knew actually quite a lot, but he had never concerned himself with Hitler's drug use. And he said that my findings actually explain this shift in Hitler's career as a military leader, which kind of changes in the summer of 1941. After that, he basically, every decision he makes is completely wrong. And before that, every decision he made militarily was brilliant. He only had successes before, and then he like slides down into, you know, making a lot of bad decisions. And you can actually see it. You can trace it. You can connect it to his drug use, which started in the summer of 1941.
Wow.
In August, when he was having quite a high fever during the campaign against Russia, and for the first time he received an opioid. And before that, he had a crazy doctor who gave him injections every day, Theo Morell. So I examined probably the patient book of, well, the notes of Morell from that I found in the archives. So I could see like every day what Hitler received.
Wow.
And in the first 5 years, he became his Hitler's doctor in 36. And from 36 to 41, Hitler basically received vitamins all the time. He was a nut for vitamins. He thought, like, if I take enough vitamins every day, I'm never going to be sick. And it was actually true. But then in the summer of 41, he actually got sick. He couldn't go to the military briefing, so he requested from his doctor, from Theo Morell, Hitler enters a new world, which is the world of hardcore drugs that he gets like injected intravenously, and he starts liking them because he's a freak in his bunker. So he doesn't meet people anymore. He becomes very shut in, so he kind of gets into like an artificial world more and more, and this world doesn't correspond less and less with the real world, where he has to take decisions how the army should move, what weapons are being developed, like what strategy. Like, the whole thing got completely over his head because he started living in a fantasy world. He was not in a fantasy world until 41. I mean, a big mistake anyhow was to attack the Soviet Union. That's unconnected to drugs. But once he's in the Soviet Union war, then he gets into more and more drugs, more and more bad decisions, less and less support from his officers, more drugs to counterbalance his you know, dwindling charisma. So you can actually explain the late Hitler much better if you understand that he became ultimately a junkie who was using intravenously high dosages of oxycodone, which created the American opioid crisis, and people usually snorted or swallow it.
Yeah.
He was actually getting it into the vein, injected by his doctor in high dosages. So he really was
heroin addict.
Not really in this world, but very high for a lot of times. And that actually led also to the degeneration of his health, which we can see clearly if we look at pictures over the years.
Wow. Well, you're kind of probably half lucky he did that, because it helped us win the war, probably.
British intelligence wanted to assassinate Hitler for a long time, and then at one point they realized we should drop that plan, because like this Hitler is actually helping us.
Wow.
Involuntarily by making bad decisions.
Yeah, there you go. Well, this has been really insightful. I've learned a lot of stuff that I didn't know about Hitler and the war, and of course the war on drugs. A lot more states in the United States are legalizing, mushroom. They're legalizing everything. I mean, they're just finding out that it's not. It just doesn't work. It's better to spend the money to open centers to get people off addiction and help people than it is to throw them in jail and just have them recidivate back. So there you go. Tell people where they can find you, Norman, on the interwebs, and order up the book.
You can find me on normanohler.com. You can find me on Instagram at normanohler, Facebook. You can find the books anywhere, I guess. Obviously, go to your local bookshop and get Tripped first, because that's a new book. And then you should, you should just have Blitz. Everyone needs to have this book on Nazis and drugs, because it's also quite funny, actually.
Oh, wow. There you go. You know, it's important to kind of learn history. Those who don't live their history are doomed to repeat it, as I like to say. So there you go. Thank you very much, Norm, for coming to the show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
There you go. Order up the book, folks, wherever fine books are sold. It's available on April 9th, 2024. Tripped, Nazi Germany, the CIA, and the Dawn of the Psychedelic Age. Thanks for coming on the show, Norman. Thanks to our audience for tuning in. Go to goodreads.com, fortresschrisfoss, linkedin.com, fortresschrisfoss, and all those crazy places on the internet. Thanks for tuning in. Be good to each other. Stay safe. And we'll see you guys next time.